of France. As she rightly recognizes, the sociologies of Durkheim and Weber have been usually described as representing two opposite paradigms. So on the one hand, you have structuralism. On the other hand, you have action-based theory or holism and individualism. Yet, Rose argues that they are both based upon a transcendental account which necessarily presupposes the actuality or existence of its object and seeks to discover the conditions of its possibility. In order to understand this argument, we need to mention very briefly Rose's critique of Kant. According to Rose, Kant transformed the logical question of validity into the epistemological question of how we may rightly acquire knowledge. Kant's critical philosophy, therefore, can be interpreted, according to Rose, as a psychological reading, for it establishes objective validity by dividing the mind into faculties and by referring to perception and representation. This element, the psychological interpretation of Kant, or this psychological fundamental element in Kant, according to Rose, reduces Kant's notion of validity to the synthesis of representations, to the description of processes of consciousness. This is one of the main problems of Kant's transcendental project, for it opens the way to an epistemological argument which A, prioritizes the problem of how knowledge is acquired over knowledge itself, and B, risks to fall into subjectivist reductionism and into pure constructivism. In order to highlight how Kant's subjectivist aporias, as it were, influenced social theory and the social sciences more in general, Gillian Ross concentrates especially on the neo-Kantian wave of the late 19th century, of the 1870s, and here particularly on the so-called Marburg and Heidelberg schools. As Gillian Ross rightly recognizes, one can find the roots of sociology, social theory more in general, and identify the barriers that prevented Hegel from becoming an equally legitimate source of inspiration for social theory, precisely in this wave of neo-Kantianism, which of course was not the only neo-Kantian wave, but this is the one on which she decides justifiably to focus. And the key name here on which she focuses is Hermann Lotze. Lotze was an absolutely central figure in the academic philosophical scene, especially at the end of the 19th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, not only in Germany, but also in the English-speaking world. If you think that his main work was translated into English at that time, and he was even called perhaps the most important philosopher worldwide. Now he's totally forgotten, nobody remembers who Lotze is, but actually we are talking about a central figure at that moment. According to Rose, and this is an essential passage, neo-Kantianism is possible only thanks to Lotze's reformulation of Kant's fundamental concept of validity. In Lotze, validity, Geltung, differs from Kant's Gültigkeit validity insofar as it pertains to propositions and not to concepts, and insofar as it has to be established independently of cognition. Lotze thus, if we want to sum up a very complicated argument, Lotze established a tripartite realm. So first, the realm of validity pertaining only to the act of thinking. Secondly, the realm of validity pertaining to validity of facts, which can be assessed on the basis of the validity established independently from cognition of facts. And third, the realm of determination of value. So, according to Rose, this is a very important passage, it was not Kant, but Lotze, who is responsible for establishing the distinction between facts and values, or validity and values, which are, according to quote Rose, ultimate, undeniable, and separate spheres of life. The crucial question with Lotze becomes, what is the nature of validity in general? And this move, namely the questioning of the validity of thought independent of the experience of objects, and this is unlike in Kant, turns Kantian logic into a general logic, namely into what she calls a methodology. to explain this passage, it turns the logic of the relation between concept and object, or subject and object, if you like, into a logic of the method, or into a meta-logic. As Ross puts it, and here I'm quoting, the transcendental approach, Kant, does not claim to be the origin of the existence of the experience, whose precondition or possibility is uncovered. The general logic, however, namely Lotze, is prescriptive and normative, not merely in relation to rules of validity, but also in relation to the creation of the object, which corresponds to those rules. This objectification is not the objectification of reality in general, but the objectification of the object domains of individual sciences. Following on Lotze's crucial importance, the two main neo-Kantian schools, namely the Marburg and the Heidegger schools I already mentioned, were basically divided between those who emphasized the question of validity and those who emphasized the question of values. But nonetheless, the common denominator between them is that the transformation of Kant's critical method into a general method excluded any inquiry into empirical reality. Objectification became the correlate of pure logic. To understand fully this argument by Rose, we should really think and bear in mind the work of these schools at the end of the 19th century. So if you look, for example, at the publications and at the work of the Heidelberg School, which is absolutely crucial, especially in the formation of Max Weber, for instance, you can see that they were entirely concentrated on questions of logic. They were particularly important in what is now called the Methodenstreit, the debate over the method between natural sciences, social sciences, sciences of spirit, etc. And what they were trying to do was precisely to understand the conditions of possibility of historical inquiry and the inquiry of social sciences, so to establish the object domain of sociology. And you can certainly not find any inquiry or any attention into concrete social realities. But this has a quite political reason, which maybe we can discuss later, because I'm not going into detail on this now. So to summarize, according to Rose, one of the most important legacies of Kant's move toward subjective validity lies in the fact that it opened the space for a general logic or methodology, which became possible by detaching the problem of how to know that we know something from the problem of knowing an object or social reality as such. However, unlike in Kant, in Lotze, as well as in the representatives of these neo-Kantian schools, the validity of knowledge is anchored not in the unity of consciousness, but in the externality of postulated truths. Thus, it is possible to create different realms of knowledge as long as different regional fields of inquiry and corresponding postulates a priori are identified. The entire debate discussion on the method is in those years, as I said, between natural and social sciences, so between economy, sociology, political science, and history, reflects this struggle. And in this regard, philosophy was no longer the queen of all sciences, or if you want, its superego, but it had to add its own specialization. However, there are two further elements that actually Gillian Rose does not mention in the book, but I think which are quite important in order to understand the neo-Kantian, even anti-Marxist move and its relation to sociology and social theory. First, in the debate over the method of natural and social sciences, to which I referred, the Heidelberg School especially, which is the school which influenced very much Max Weber, established that the goal of the social sciences is to understand and to explain individuality and to avoid laws and generalizations regarding any totality. Thus, they established a division between so-called analytic logic, namely a Kantian logic, and what they called emanatistic logic, namely which was the Hegelian logic, and it's called emanatistic. It's a very strange word, because the idea is that it is the logic for which reality emanates, if you want, from the concept, so from this idea of, if you want, mainstream idea of Hegel's idealism. Emil Lask, in particular, developed this idea, this distinction between analytic and emanatistic logic. And again, Emil Lask is a figure absolutely forgotten. Nobody knows who Emil Lask was. But again, Emil Lask was a very important neo-Kantian philosopher. He was very influential on Weber, but also on Lukács. And Rose discusses especially the influence of Lask on Lukács. The main problem with the emanatistic logic for Lask consisted in the fact that Hegelian logic identifies the individual as an ontological nullity, as the finite or the negative, while the analytic logic is able to identify the notion with the notion of individuality, so to recognize the individuality. Therefore, analytic logic is to be preferred to emanatistic logic because the latter denies history its own object, in denying that individuality possesses real existence. This is a very important point to understand also historically the anti-Marxist move, the anti-socialist move of the neo-Kantian school, because by identifying history with the concern for individuality, they wanted to deny basically the Marxist argument, if you like, that there are laws of history or structural elements in society that can be identified by means of generalizations. They were absolutely against this idea, but again, it's not just because of there was also a political reason for this. But we can go on this later. Second, since facts and values are conceived either as coinciding at a normative level, as for example in Heinrich Richter, or as separate for the sake of scientific neutrality, as in Weber, the result is twofold. First, bourgeois values are posited as universal and normative for inquiry into reality. Second, they are declared as subjective positions which should not be confused with the objectivity and neutrality of sciences, thus concealing the fundamental value or orientation of modern science. The latter position became the dominant one in social sciences and probably sciences more in general, precisely the idea of the neutrality of the scientific enterprise and the idea that there should not be values, especially political values, involved in science, especially in social sciences. This way of proceeding is for Rawls entirely consistent with the functioning of capitalist society. Rawls illustrates this point in a particularly convincing and brilliant way by referring to Weber's methodological and theoretical operation, as she regards him as the most influential figure in the social sciences in the 20th century. Weber's work, according to Rawls, summarized the entire neo-Kantian operation in the realm of the social sciences. First, because he developed a critical sociology of capitalism without fundamentally making value judgments of capitalism. Second, because the separation between values and facts in Weber becomes the separation between means and ends in the practice of the social scientist. Since the social sciences must function according to instrumental rationality, they examine the relation between means and ends, but do not assess the ends themselves. And ultimately for Rawls, the philosophical assumptions of social theory, which are grounded in neo-Kantianism, became first the idea that subjective validity of values is a starting point which cannot be questioned. Second, the idea that social reality or culture is itself a constellation or result of value-oriented actions in which social determinants, structural determinants have less importance. And you can just think here, just to have a concrete example of all the flourishing of empirical sociology, questionnaires, Gallup polls, for which the main point is to understand, if you want, empirical phenomenon, social reality, by understanding what people think about it, instead of understanding, if you want, structural determinants. And this is entirely consistent with this idea that culture is the result of value-oriented actions. Third, another important assumption is the idea that social reality is a meaningless infinity, and this is the way in which Weber termed it, which is signified by value-oriented actions of individuals. The task of the social scientist, therefore, becomes the interpretation of portions of reality by means of the development of ideal types of cultural constellations. And this leads, as a result, to the subsequent proliferation of countless sub-disciplines, specializations, in which the social is fractured into countless regions, for the study of which different tools, methodologies, and micro-theories are developed. We could argue that such a sociology is today the most visible result of this victory of the neo-Kantian project. So just to understand how I think this has been so successful, we can think that the controversy, the famous debate between Popper and Adorno today would be absolutely inconceivable, precisely because the idea that society can be thought as a totality has absolutely lost. It's not possible anymore to think in sociology in these terms. Now, in the second part, I will very briefly highlight the reasons why for Gillian Rose, the Hegelian paradigm is incompatible with the neo-Kantian one. She suggests that is why Hegel's thought already preempted and strongly criticized neo-Kantian arguments in a way that would lead us to think social theory in a very different way. For Rose, one of the problems that inhibited the retrieval of Hegelian thinking was the fact that both Hegelian Marxist and non-Marxist social theorists were themselves fundamentally influenced by neo-Kantianism. As far as the Marxist sociology, social theory in general is concerned, and she thinks especially of Lukács, Althusser, and Adorno, she argues that it is Marxist sociology is responsible for a mystification of Hegel, as it made a distinction between a radical method on the one hand and a conservative system on the other hand. So those critics of Hegel who divide his thought into a method and a system, according to Rose, impose a schema on it which he fundamentally rejected. This schema mystifies instead of clarifying the connection between Hegel's systematic ambitions and his critique of Kantian critical method. As a result, I'm quoting, both the non-Marxist and the Marxist critiques of Hegel attempt to drop the notion of the absolute, but at the same time retain the social import of Hegel's thought. Rose's main thesis, in fact, is that the absolute, as she puts it, is not an optional extra, as it were, for Hegel's philosophy has no social import if the absolute is banished or suppressed, if the absolute cannot be thought. So I think now we need to understand what is the absolute, which is something which is not exactly totally self-evident. And what does it mean to suggest that the way to make Hegel a point of reference for social theory means to retrieve his notion of the absolute? I think in order to understand this point of her argument, we need to focus on Rose's reconstruction of Hegel's fundamental opposition to Kant. To think the absolute, in other words, means to be able to abolish three things. First, to abolish the idea of the noumenon as a socially and politically disempowering idea. Second, to understand science as a struggle, not edification, that really attempts to understand the development of social reality and not to impose on it a method or tool by means of which a social reality can be subsumed or from which it can be deduced at the outset. And third, we need to retrieve speculative thought against transcendental thought. So first, to think the absolute as abolishing the noumenon. For Rose, Hegel's main critique of Kant is that transcendental method restricts knowledge to finite knowledge, and so it makes even finite objects unknowable. As she puts it, I'm quoting, in the name of a neutral method which seeks solely to justify knowledge, transcendental philosophy justifies infinite ignorance, not finite knowledge. The assumption regarding the impossibility of knowing the thing in itself prevents us from recognizing, criticizing, and therefore from changing the social and political relations which determine us. Second, think the absolute as understanding science as struggle and not edification. Here the point for Rose is to understand that against the use of method as a tool to be applied to the inquiry of reality from outside and at the outset, Hegel for Rose maintains that it is only at the end of an inquiry into the development of reality itself that the method of its development can be discerned. As Hegel puts it, I think this is very clear, especially in a passage from the preface to the Phenomenology of Spirit, which I'm quoting, the concern with the aim or results is an easier task than it might seem. For instead of getting involved in the real issue, this kind of activity is always a way beyond it. Instead of tearing with it and losing itself in it, this kind of knowing is forever grasping at something new. It remains essentially preoccupied with itself instead of being preoccupied with the real issue and surrounding to it. And especially this passage suggests somehow the title of my paper today, which is exactly knowing how to swim before jumping into the water. And this it's a critique of neo-Kantianism precisely because of this reason, because it's the idea neo-Kantians were preoccupied to have the rules for swimming before jumping into the water, while Hegel wants to learn how to swim while he's already in the water, so he jumps into it. And I found it, this is an anecdote actually, which I was told by Mladen, unfortunately Mladen is not here, in which he says that this was suggested by Lacan, when in one of his seminars, Lacan terms Hegel the most sublime of the hysterics. And so he calls Hegel an hysteric precisely because he's not afraid of jumping into the water, while Kant is always very worried and he has to keep control of everything. So he's a neurotic, basically. And I thought it was quite interesting. Okay, so third, to think the absolute, we need to retrieve speculative thought against transcendental thought. In this regard, for us, it is essential to make clear how Hegel's speculative thought is not to be confused with a philosophy of identity. Most readings, according to Rose, have tended to treat Hegel's propositions in terms of identities, as they divide the sentence into a grammatical subject and predicate joined by the copula is. Here I'm quoting Rose, the grammatical subject is considered a fixed bearer of variable accidents, the grammatical predicates, which yielded the content of the proposition. It was in order to challenge the problem of identity proper of the prepositional form that Hegel proposed that the prepositional form must be read as a speculative proposition. As Rose puts it, to read a proposition speculatively means that the identity which is affirmed between subject and predicate is seen equally to affirm a lack of identity between subject and predicate. From this perspective, the subject is not fixed, nor the predicate accidental. They acquire their meaning in a series of relations to each other. For us, in the end, speculative thought expressed Hegel's understanding of bourgeois society based on property relations. The lack of identity between subject and its predicates, to be understood as their non-fixity, relates to a system in which law is separated from the rest of social life. Bourgeois property relations are based on a lack of identity, for they make people into competing, isolated moral individuals who can only relate externally to one another and are thus subjected to a real lack of identity. Furthermore, according to Rose, it is necessary to read speculatively also Hegel's two most famous propositions, namely what is actually is rational and what is rational is actual, or philosophy is its time apprehended in thought. here again, for Rawls, does not want to justify the status quo, which is usually the reading of these propositions, but on the contrary, he suggests that shorten it, it's time for philosophy to go back to the unity of philosophy and the polis. But I don't go too much into this, because I know that Harrison is going to talk precisely more on speculative thought and the ratio with Hegel's analysis of bourgeois society. So in the end, for Rawls, Hegel was a thinker of unification of theory and practice, a stronger critique of property relations, and of the illusion of its universal form in bourgeois society, as well as a strong opponent of specialized forms of knowledge, which misunderstand and mystify the complexity of social reality and its speculative nature. Now, I would like to raise a few critical questions at the end, and I'm really going to conclude. So far, I've tried to emphasize some of the, which I find the most interesting and original elements of Rawls's account. But I think there are also some important limits in Rawls's approach, which nonetheless are important to keep in mind in order to rethink Hegel and his legacy for Marxism and social theory. First, it seems to me that one of the main limits of this work is that Rawls fails to provide an historical contextualization for argument. So we don't really understand why did the return to Kant end up serving the aims of what became a sociology and social theory, because, for example, there was also a return to Hegel at the beginning of the 20th century, especially by these same authors. For example, some of the Heidelberg School representatives, like Windelband, they went back to Hegel after being neo-Kantian. So it's not really clear, and historical contextualization would have helped, in my view, to understand better this argument. Second, this is more complicated. If thought is to be commensurate with social reality, so the apprehension of time in thought, would it not be possible to argue on the same basis that Hegel's speculative non-identitarian thought was not possible precisely because the social, historical, and economical conditions for it to be possible were not yet actual? And so I think this is something to raise. Similarly, couldn't we argue that a philosophy which represents and justifies the specialization of disciplines in a context which is increasingly fragmented and in which there is an increasing division of labor, which also is expressed in the division between disciplines. So this kind of philosophy able to grasp this increasing division, is a philosophy well placed to be able precisely to grasp and to serve this tendency in society? So to some extent, neo-Kantianism, if you want, express better, if you want, apprehends this element of capitalist society in thought. Therefore, if Hegel's philosophy as non-identitarian thought is the apprehension of its time in thought, but not the transformation of that time, can we say that neo-Kantianism, with its ideological separation between means and ends, values and facts, subject and object, and its focus upon individuality rather than upon social totality, was the one which could best apprehend this change brought about by capitalism? Rawls somehow seems to recognize this problem when she admits that if we cannot think the absolute, this means that it is therefore not our thought in the sense of not realized. But if the absolute is the reconciliation of practical and theoretical reason, subject and object, that cannot be thought because their dichotomies and determinations are not transcended, we can say, does not Rawls run the risk of presenting Hegel as a thinker who wants to transcend them still in the realm of ideas? So I think in the end, she, especially at the end of the book, she's quite critical of Marx, because she believes Marx did not grasp this fundamental element of Hegel. But I would say that she's not very fair, perhaps, with Marx in this respect, because I think that Marx tries precisely to deal with this problem in Hegel. However, and here I'm really concluding, I think the two fundamental reasons why I believe Rawls's main argument on the necessity of retrieving Hegel's thought for social theory is still relevant is, first, because I think in the Hegelian Renaissance that we can witness now amongst some of the most prominent Marxist theorists, you can think of Jameson, but also Zizek now writing on Hegel, there seems to be this, at least in Jameson, perhaps the critic of Rose, for which usually Marxist, Hegelian Marxists tend to divide the radical method from the conservative system. Seems to me that can be still applied, for example, to Jameson. So I think he tends to do this. And second, I think this book is still very important, especially for those who are interested in the philosophical foundation, for example, of sociology, and I am particularly interested in this element. I think that against the empirical reductionism, contemporary social sciences, and this endless fragmentation into sub-regions of a disciplinary inquiry, it is important to reassess with Rose, following Hegel, that the grasp of the social totality and its inherent contradictions is still the most important task of social theory.
Thank you. Now Harrison.
Yes. Using Sarah's explanations of speculative experience and Rose's analysis of Hegel to analyze bourgeois social relations. So the title of my paper is called The Spiritual Animal Kingdom on Gillian Rose's Hegelian Critique of Bourgeois Society. In Gillian Rose's Hegel Contra Sociology, Hegel's philosophy is established as going far beyond abstract metaphysics. For Rose, the real contribution Hegel makes for social analysis anticipates Marx, and even, in certain respects, surpasses Marx. Hegel reveals the dialectical unity of forms of thought with their social correlates, and his criticisms of the most abstract ideas of philosophical discourse show the concrete social relations they presuppose. It is the supreme merit of Rose that she brilliantly explains how Hegel's categories are saturated with political and social significance. His philosophy is not so much a contemplative exercise, or of just, to put it another way, the owl of Minerva spreading its wings at dusk. This owl also takes flight of dawn and heralds the return of Athena and of a world where we can experience freedom without domination. Rose argues that Hegel is not a thinker who seeks to resolve and reconcile all contradictions into a system of thought, but makes evident the deep and lacerating contradictions that constitute bourgeois society, specifically at the level of its property relations. I will argue here that the idea Rose sees as the most important for social critique is Hegel's conception of the spiritual animal kingdom. This image of the spiritual animal kingdom epitomizes the real and mystifying dynamics of bourgeois society. It is a kingdom which results when abstract, universal consciousness appears to treat other as ends in themselves, but actually treats others and itself as a means. Each particular consciousness in the kingdom limits itself to its own tasks and particular kinds of work, and understands its activities as contributing to the common good, but it is a deceived consciousness, and instead of a common good, only manages to serve the antisocial interests of private property. According to Rose, Hegel's critique of civil society is not conducted under the lens of the master-slave dialectic, as many Marxists have used to analyze the relationship of classes under capital. Explicitly contra Alexander Kojève, for Rose's Hegel, the spiritual animal kingdom of bourgeois society is where there is apparent harmony, but it cannot operate according to a master-slave dialectic, since the bondage that the worker faces is not a transparent one, but is masked by the universalizing ideology of equality of persons under the law. Rose is not concerned with transparent relations of bondage, but how their abstraction of the equality of persons becomes separated from the rest of social life, or how our experience of universality as modern subjects is in fact an illusory one. What Kojève lacks in his dialectic, then, is an adequate analysis of the political and legal superstructure of bourgeois law, of the concept of the person that makes this experience of the bifurcation of universal and particular interests possible in the first place. Without the mediating step of persons, Kojève assumes that the future belongs to the slaves once they have overthrown their masters. The slave for Kojève is the active side of history, who, through his work and activity, transforms the world according to his wants and desires and demands the recognition of his humanity. But for Rose, the work activity of the slave is not enough as a formative experience of universality, and bourgeois society actually represents the victory of the master. It cannot belong to the slaves, since here the master becomes master and slave. These are the persons of civil society, and they know themselves only as masters, but do not know that they are really slaves to private property. It is only in bourgeois society that a deceiving consciousness is possible, where essentially the private interests of selfish actors are seamlessly reified as constituting the unity of social life. Here, the fantasy of formal equality masks the real contradictions of class. Thus, the forms of domination we experience under the yoke of capital are mediated by the relations that arise between people when they define themselves as persons. Persons is the term for bearers of legal property rights, according to Roman and modern law. And for Rose and Hegel, these laws install a reign of abstraction of how things which are particular and different can be converted into an abstract identity. But all of this presupposes a real lack of identity between the particular and the universal, and is a mark of what Rose calls after Hegel relative ethical life. The same identity between different things in commodity exchange is reproduced in a formal way in how people are relatively identical before the law as persons, where persons are those who have the abstract right to property. But what is relative here is how the concept of equal persons presupposes an actual relation of lack and cannot be said to constitute an absolute ethical life, since the very idea of personhood rests on specific people who have not been taken up into the legal concept of personhood, i.e., of those who do not have property. What follows from this is while the reigning concept of the person levels out everyone ideologically as equals, this formal recognition of property relations presupposes the subordination of others to those who have property. One person recognized by the law as a property owner thus can act as the cause or the unity of others, and may act as what gives meaning and purpose to social bonds. Rose cites how vehemently Hegel reacted against deriving real ethical relations out of bourgeois property relations, reminding us how opposed he was to any contractarian model of the state. As a side note, though not insignificant, Hegel's vehemence extends to Kant's notion of marriage as a contract, famously satirized by Bertolt Brecht. Brecht called this particular notion the agreement concerning reciprocal use of chattels and sexual organs, which Kant calls marriage. From Rose's reading, Hegel sees Kant and Fichte as the real philosophical architects of capitalist social relations, of how their very oppositions between theoretical and practical reason of concepts and intuitions reinscribes the basic dynamics of the exploitation of man and nature. In Kantian ethical theory, as critiqued by Hegel in his early essay on natural law, all specific and historical aspects of social life are abstracted in order to affirm the goodwill of the moral individual in itself. This will is treated in isolation to others and thereby excludes itself from any real sense of unity. Even the postulation of our unity of the moral law with God as a regulative idea, or of our ability to actualize our subjective maxims as universal in the realm of contingency, is a case of illusory thinking for Hegel, since these things are merely posited and are not grounded in actual relations. But these apparently abstract notions of freedom that Kant and Fichte advance have their own social logic. These notions are in fact informed by the real social circumstances of specific bourgeois property relations, and Hegel tries to show how, with reference to Kant's examples, that private property is smuggled in and affirmed by Kant's formal ethical criteria. Ideas concerning property in Kant satisfy the acid test of universalizability. And to use just one example, Kant insists that deposits shouldn't be appropriated to merely increase our fortune, since if one universalizes maxim, then deposits would cease to exist. However, Hegel finds this whole procedure tautological and spurious. It is tautological because it assumes the existence of deposits from the outset, and it is spurious since private property resists the conceit of universalizability. Private property is something conditioned, i.e., it is something that is determined by specific social relations. But Kant attempts to transform these relations into unconditionally moral ones, and thereby conceals the suppression of any concrete universality private property denies. It is thus immoral for Kant to universalize any subjective maxim of the will, which presupposes the institution of private property, since private property, by its very own definition, cannot be universal. Continuing in his essay on natural law, Hegel argues how property itself is directly opposed to universality, and when it is equated with it, it is abolished. The new legal order of private property comes into being when the poetry of Greek life, according to Hegel, of the relatively integral nature of the polis for its citizens, is replaced by the prose of the world, which Hegel equates with the rise of Rome. It means the development of a prosaic existence where we experience a complex division of labor, a divorce of custom from law, and an attenuation of meaning in art and religion, as they are unable to articulate the reality of a total ethical life. This is a world founded on force and perpetuated by force, though it develops a form of law that preserves the status quo of inequality through the institutions of private property. Roman law is innovative because it gives us the concept of the person, i.e. of those who can own property. But this concept of abstract personhood conceals the differences between people of persons who are dependent on others. Again, from this vantage of abstract equality, such distinctions in power cannot be seen. In fact, these are distinctions ultimately based on exploitation and force, since private property is not one's own work, but has been appropriated from others. Abstract personhood shifts the status of the appropriator and the appropriated, and helps to render exploitation invisible. From the period of lawlessness and the anarchy of feudalism, what Hegel calls those long and terrible nights of the Middle Ages, bourgeois consciousness reacts as separate from this chaotic reality, reactivating the ideas of Roman abstract universality against the world of accident and contingency. But this assertion of bourgeois law only fixes the accidents of plunder and pillage into determinate forms of private property, where the accidents themselves are guaranteed as law. The abstraction of the law grows haughty against the phenomenal world and thinks of itself as unconditioned against a conditional realm. It represents itself as a law of freedom against necessity. It misunderstands that its so-called unconditional law is actually a product of the accidents of private possession. It treats these possessions as inexplicable facts of reason, and not as the contingent relations of domination they really are. The categorical imperative this world fashions for itself of attempting to universalize the subjective maxims of the current social reality cannot so easily neutralize the particularist and anti-universalist core at the heart of private property. The Kantian alchemy of converting private property into universally binding laws is treated by Hegel as invalid and an invalid way of achieving immunity from the specific and conditioned nature of private property. This entire process of substituting the particular for what is truly universal through Kant also operates according to the logic of a deceiving consciousness. It is deceptive because it acknowledges the partiality of the law towards private property, but looks as if it recognizes these forms as universal, while it can only truly acknowledge private interests. we can now come to a richer definition of the spiritual animal kingdom. It's a kingdom where the work performed seems of universal worth, that the work of one is really contributing to the work of all, and it can be called a spiritual kingdom, since the transformative activity of work outwardly fuses the particular with the universal, or subsumes, as in Kant, the intuition under the concept. But it remains an animalistic domain. The self-consciousness exhibited here can only acknowledge the activity it performs as its own and excludes others from it. The harmony of the particular and the universal turns out to be a deceptive appearance of what is actually a Hobbesian war of particular interests clashing, of vying for supremacy over each other. What is produced really isn't universal work, but instead is work that only serves particular ends. Once more, this kingdom is not of the Kojevian kind, of one that conforms to the master-slave dialectic, since the deception of abstract universality works to strengthen the appearance of harmony, while a master-slave dialectic is based on the immediacy of bondage. The work in the spiritual animal kingdom appears transparent too, but it's a false transparency of universality and not of domination. In Hegel, we can only break out of this falsity and illusion from a perspective that can think unity in difference. It is from the perspective of his absolute idea, where the relative identities, relative because they are not truly identical or coherent, between subject and object, concept and content, and the contradictory relations of bourgeois society, can be criticized. The absolute is an idea that emerges through a critique of actually existing relations, and the human subject understands this idea not only in thought, but through the construction of a good and free society. If we accept the premises of Hegel's critique of the relative ethical life of bourgeois society and see these Kantian antinomies as real problems in need of resolution, then the absolute idea for Hegel and for Rose is necessary for social critique. Without it, Hegel's philosophy has no social import for Rose, as it would lack the right standard of freedom from which to judge relative ethical existence and recognizing its contradictions. Our ability to think the absolute cannot be elaborated here in much detail for such a limited presentation, nor, quite frankly, is it possible to exhaust it in any format, since its recognition demands a constant tracing and retracing of its moments. But by tracing the contradictions within bourgeois society and taking them seriously, we can start to think about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we're going to have two sets of comments for the discussion. So Jim, you want to go first?
I apologize. We had a little trouble getting hold of each other's the papers, so this is somewhat spontaneous. And I'm so grateful for, among other things, people don't read Hegel because they can't understand Hegel, and when people don't read Jilly Rose because they can't understand Jilly Rose, she's pretty tough too. And both these papers are really great unpackers of two tough thinkers, and I think it's really grateful. I guess I'm coming at the topic as one who thinks that if you don't at least buy this from Rose, if you don't buy that, you better come to Marx through Hegel. If you don't come to Marx through Hegel, you're going to come to Marx through Kant, and if you come to Marx through Kant, you'll never get to Marx. It's just, I think, in a way, that simple, really, except it's not simple. And what's not simple about it is that we inherit, just by living on Earth, out of dimension going to university, the categories of a neo-Kantian culture. I mean, all education, you could be a physics and math major. As a physics and math major, you might think, oh, you're on the Naturwissenschaft side, but no, you're not. You're on the Naturwissenschaft side who says, oh, knowledge is socially constructed, representing certain interests of us using methods of the scientific community. And you pretty much could kind of like go point by point down a neo-Kantian of one path or another view of knowledge. There's no escaping it, really. And so kind of, these are just sort of some of my little kind of litmus tests for when I'm kind of moving a little way away from those powerful modes. And why I think they're to be taken so seriously is I think they generate skepticism by their very nature. I mean, I think Kant in his sort of schools, various forms of skepticism with their, you know, well, it's true for us, but is it really true, you know, to take one of the forms of skepticism, okay? And so how do I know I'm kind of moving beyond that is when I just ask myself, well, is it true? And I don't worry about, well, is it true for us or is it really true? Because that's sort of a mark of kind of Hegel's critique of Kant, that you stop worrying about what you're bringing, you know, my prejudices and my biases and my language and my culture and my worldview and my frameworks and my paradigm, and sort of like try to get to the issue, the problem, you know, and make mistakes. But when I make mistakes, the mistakes aren't because something's in my head and I haven't gotten out of my head. It's just because I didn't get it right, you know? So let's try and do better, okay? And I say that because I think that Rose is really speaking to, you know, a kind of tragedy, you know, that in this sort of powerful time in history when something like capitalism is really remaking the planet, the universe, history in so many powerful ways, we have such poverty of concepts to talk about what's happening all around us, because the concepts that we're inheriting are essentially coming out of whether Marburg or Heidelberg, you know, one of the problems with that chapter one that you unpacked so well is it's just really difficult. You know, you can sort of end up in a labyrinth of neo-Kantians, you know, the validity versus the value neo-Kantians, the sort of force versus the, you know, free choosing neo-Kantians. I don't think we should get lost there. I think we should kind of keep our eye on the prize in terms of trying to understand the modern world and seeing how this inheritance has made it that much more difficult, okay? So, I mean, and I'll just say this, that one of the drawbacks from realizing how important Hegel is that Hegel doesn't have a concept of capital, as far as I can tell. And so some of the most important things that we have to try and figure out, he doesn't really get. But what he does in his kind of unpacking of some of the contradictions of civil society, how law functions, is he allows us to get into, he's like sensing the problems, you know? On the Jewish question, I think is inspired her. I don't know how often she quoted it, but that view of law and on the Jewish question, where it's this, you know, he talks a lot about the North American colonies, Marx, and how the laws kind of set up this sort of freedom to be selfish and egoistic and just kind of pursue your own self-interest, that sort of freewheeling particularity. And I guess maybe I want to speak a little critically of Rose. I thought your last questions about why has neo-Kant, I mean, I just thought they're wonderful, you know, and why are they so powerful? Certainly, what you suggested, one of the reasons why they're so powerful is they emphasize the moral, one way or the other, even if it's sort of like just subjective values in your head, they emphasize that there is a moral reality. And I think Hegel's kind of disturbing sort of senses doesn't really have, like, Hegel's, you know, I mean, he integrates morality all the way down, which is almost more than we can conceive. That you're always in the moral realm. It's not like, okay, here's the facts, and now what do you think about it, you know? So it's, and I think that's really a powerful lure of Kant, that we want to be moral. We want to say, is it right, or is it sort of free? And this is easier to see it this way. And Hegel's is real, it's really harder, and it's there in Marx. So when you teach Capital Volume 1, your students will say, yeah, but is it wrong? And you're saying, okay, every sentence in that book is talking about what it means to be a human being in a capitalist society. It's not like, and then at the end we're going to sort of have a moral evaluation. Every category is moral. Money is moral. Commodity is moral. You know, and that sort of way of looking at the world is really, I think, what Rose is trying to kind of recall for us. She sees it somehow as rooted in the early Hegelian writings on the early Jena systems. I find that to be somewhat doubtful. You know, the natural law essay. I'm a fan of the developmental view of Hegel, that he's sort of changes some of his, and I guess I just question that sort of reading of Hegel where so much emphasis is put on the very early and the very late, and in between is kind of, for example, I think there is a sense in the, on the Jewish question where law seems like this expression of sort of fragmentation, very far from the sort of organic community of a truly ethical, absolute ethical world. But then you get into capital and you realize that formal legality is at the fundamental basis of the wage relations. It's only because everyone does own their own labor power, that's the one property we do have, that we can sell our labor power. And that legality isn't just an illusion, it is generated from a capitalist totality. It takes you into, so it's not just sort of this sort of happy land of, you know, ends, community of ends, where we're sort of mystified and not really seeing. So I think the later Hegel, where he gets really into modern institutions, is much more promising than I think she sort of allows for. I guess kind of one of my suspicions for, if you put a lot of emphasis on the early Hegel, he's under this, you know, a lot of his vocabulary is from Kant, you know, and he's still working it out. You go later in Hegel, you just don't, he's not worried about concepts and percepts. His idea of sort of truth is not when we finally put the concepts and percepts together. That's kind of like, doesn't get, because every percept is conceptual. There's no perception that's not, doesn't have a conceptual form about it. And that sort of external model is that a, should I stop now?
No, you have five more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, is kind of a, you know, it runs through the Rose book, because very often when she sort of harkens back to this kind of memory of a moral polis, it's in terms of putting things together, like let's put together law and custom, or let's put together the individual and the community, or let's put together gods and persons. And that sort of, it's a kind of unity that I think is really a sort of not where Hegel's going to go. I think that he starts there in terms of legality and morality have to be as one, the theoretical and the practical have to be as one, unified. I think where Hegel's going to go is really where there is no dualism between concepts and persons. There certainly are plenty of contradictions in society, but that's not one you have to unify. I don't think he thinks there's any dualism between the theoretical and the practical. And so it's not like an ethical society is where we're going to unify that, because, I mean, he's not saying there's not a difference between theoretical and practical. It's not a dualism. So that's not going to certainly be a mark of sort of a utopian society when we can unify those. He gets, I think his categories get to be much better later on, and he's able, which is by way of saying it's not exactly clear where, if Hegel's has that utopian kind of vision later on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he's really sort of embedded in the modern world, the contradictions of the modern world, even though he doesn't get to the contradictions of capitalism, he's really there. He's sort of like opens the door, Marx charges through, I think. And whether we can get beyond them, whether his reconciliation isn't really a reconciliation of thought, art, religion, sort of the spiritual, cultural kinds of expressions, it's kind of where I think the absolute really leads him with a rather resigned view of history. But still calling it freedom and still calling it rational, but just not rational enough. Okay, that's my time.
Thank you. Roger?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to, I've got a few different points, I'll try to put them together as best I can here. Marx used the phrase in a letter to refer to Annenkov talking about Proudhon around the time that he's writing The Poverty of Philosophy, about Proudhon operating within the bourgeois horizon. And I think that's a phrase that to pay attention to, and actually phrases like that are scattered around Marx's work. Because the bourgeois horizon, I think what Marx means by that is something that's broader than the critique of political economy, subtitle of Capital, and you know where he really puts a lot of his effort later on in life. And you know we're familiar with the 1844 manuscripts being called economic and philosophic manuscripts. Poverty of Philosophy is a kind of dual critique of Proudhon's kind of half-baked Hegelianism and his effort to sort of use Ricardian principles to give us some kind of more liberated political economy. So I think that's something that is really to keep in mind, almost like a stereoscopic vision here. And I think Julian Rose is really helpful in that, with the whole critique of the neo-Kantianism, because I think that really is sort of getting at, if not the whole of it, a really important part of what this bourgeois horizon, what this underlying bourgeois mindset. I mean, I think of the theses on Feuerbach, where Marx is criticizing not just idealism, but also materialism. Why? Well, because they have something in common. What's that thing in common? Well, I think that's what he's trying to target with the bourgeois horizon. And I think it is this kind of dualistic philosophy that Rose is going after here. But with that in mind, about the same year that, within a year or two of Rose's book coming out, I think another really important book came out by Simon Clark called Marx, Marginalism, and Modern Sociology. And that's a book, I think, that, you know, using the stereoscopic scheme, put those two books together, because what Simon Clark is arguing is that, well, I'll read a little bit of what he says. He says, there was a scientific revolution in the 19th century social thought. And he's really addressing neoclassical theory, neoclassical economics. That people perceive that as the marginalist revolution, late 19th century. So just the same period that we're discussing here, well, with the neo-Kantians. But it was one that Parsons, the sociologist, ignored. It was inaugural. So the real revolution for Clark was Marx's critique of the ideological foundations of classical political economy, which he located in the political economist's neglect of the social form of capitalist production, which was the basis of their naturalization of capitalist social relations. For Marx, society could not be explained abstractly on the basis of the confrontation between abstract individuals and an abstract nature, so individuals facing scarcity, a world of scarcity, trying to make rational decisions. Capitalist society is a society based on a particular social form of production, within which the production and reproduction of material things is subordinated to the production and accumulation of surplus value, and within which the participation of the individual in society is conditional on the individual's insertion into the social relations of production. Thus, Marx's critique of political economy established an alternative foundation on which to build a theory of capitalist society whose fundamental concepts would be those of value, surplus value, and class. So that's a kind of approach that really emphasizes that the fundamental problem with classical political economy, but also with neoclassical, which is even more vulgar, is that the idea of the social form of wealth, social form of production, social forms of labor, those specific forms, are not ingredients of the theory. On the contrary, neoclassical presents itself as if it were some kind of generally applicable social science. So that, I think, to see neoclassical economics as really another form of neo-Kantianism, and really to sort of, I think, to kind of, so that's my first kind of thought here, is to read these two books in a sense together, and that, I think, would really continue Marx's approach of a kind of stereoscopic critique of philosophy and critique of bourgeois political economy, or what I would just call economics. Okay, I think that just to pick up on something Gene was saying, I have a little trouble with Rose's reading of Hegel. I mean, I think Hegel really, there's a long book by H.S. Harris on Hegel's development toward the sunlight. And what I took away from that book was really the idea that the real struggle of Hegel for a long time was really coming to grips with modern commercial society and basically reconciling himself to it. And it seems to me like that's what you get in his mature work, in The Philosophy of Right. It seems to me you've got somebody who's not, you know, like inalterably opposed to private property, but someone who's reconciled himself to it. I find philosophy to write the whole treatment of civil society in particular really a kind of amazing track. I think Hegel, for somebody who's reconciling himself to civil society, he has a lot of really damning things to say about it. Basically, we're under the domination of abstractions, very much like Marx. I mean, from Marx's point of view, you'd say the power of the law of value to come crashing down on our heads is something that he recognizes, the problem of poverty. I mean, any number of really serious problems. But I think he's really, and this following up on Gene, I think he's really kind of reconciled himself to that. Moreover, and this also, I think, refers to something Gene was saying toward the end here, I think there's a logical dimension to that. So Rose is almost like, oh, private property. Well, I mean, it's almost like this. Well, no, we can't have private property because, hello, it's private. We want the universal. Well, I think that kind of thinking of Hegel really calls into question. I'm going to read two passages from Hegel. It might seem that universal ends would be more readily attained if the universal absorbed the strength of the particulars in the way described, for example, in Plato's Republic. But this, too, is only an illusion, since both universal and particular turn into one another and exist only for and by means of one another. If I further my ends, I further the ends of the universal, and this, in turn, furthers my end. Well, that's a little different view. And here he's in an even stronger passage, Hegel again. The wish to have the whole in every particular could be fulfilled only by the destruction of the particular. And fanaticism is just the refusal to give scope to particular differences. So that's pretty strong. And it makes me wonder, I think you can wonder about certain formulations of Marx, like from the time of the Jewish question and notes on James Mill and stuff like that, whether or not that kind of perspective on unifying the particular and the universal might not be a possible basis for criticism of Marx. And I think this is why Hegel really gets into this whole issue of mediating institutions and so on, and is willing to take on board a lot of what he very clearly puts as bad stuff. Now, on the other hand, also something Gene mentioned, I don't know, the whole idea of Hegel talking about exploitation. Hegel, I mean, even in the philosophy of right, he has the business class. He doesn't have the distinction between the capitalist class and the working class. So how does he have, where does he have a kind of fundamental Marxian conception of exploitation? I mean, where's that? I don't see it. I agree. I don't think he has the concept of capital. I mean, again, I think he's, you know, it's brilliant. It's brilliant stuff. It seems to me that, and Marx's whole treatment too, of Marx's first great work, in my view, was his attempt to criticize the philosophy of right. But I think Capital is really the mature version of his critique of philosophy, right? And in general, his critique of bourgeois right theory. I mean, that, and you can see that in the whole kind of way that you get the reversal of sort of the Lockean law of property, okay? I mean, that you get this reversal. And again, you can't begin to get at that on Hegel's conceptual basis, because you get this really crazy thing where even the whole sense of the contract, the wage-labor contract, when you get farther into Capital, it turns out that the money, the M, that the capitalist is putting up front, that's not like something that the capitalist got a paper route, worked hard and saved for, and that's accumulated surplus value that was exploited from past generations of wage workers. So you don't have anything like that. So the whole profound critique of bourgeois philosophy of right that Capital represents, I don't think you get that in Hegel. This maybe just a couple words on method and content. I mean, I think one of the striking things about Rose's book is how strong an affirmation of Hegel it is. Whereas the young Marx, I mean, he's a tremendous enthusiast for Hegel in a sense, but he also really picks up on Feuerbach's critique. In a sense, the young Marx is saying, you talk a good game to Hegel, but actually, you're doing this kind of imposition of, I mean, he's taking this from Feuerbach, basically, you're kind of imposing this pre-established logic, which is really just the same problem, the fundamental problem within the Kantians and the neo-Kantians. He's saying, Hegel, I see you don't want to do that, but you are doing that. So that when you talk about as if like the like this whole thing about dividing the method and the content, I mean, Marx is already critical, very critical of the method in a way. Now, on the other hand, he says, oh, Hegel discovered dialectic, and that's the, so that's part of the story. But he also has this profound, and I don't think he ever takes that back, that kind of Feuerbachian thing. He may be wrong about it.
He is.
I think he probably is for the most part. And then on the other hand, the content, the conservative content, again, there's a lot of really, really strong stuff in terms of the content that it already in the philosophy of right for all of its shortcomings. That's really critical. And you see something like Avenari's book years ago, picking up on the problem of poverty. That was to kind of use the content of the philosophy of right in a critical way.
Great, thank you. We have about 36 for discussion. So I think that what we'll do is I will take up to 3 questions, then I will have the panelists answer them, and then we'll go along.
Can you also react to the discussants?
Sure. Anybody, if you want to respond to the discussants first, you want to do that?
No, maybe
okay.
So we don't want to
do it in the context.
No, exactly. Right. Let's talk about the people.
All right.
Course.
Terrific. Questions. Alberto.
This is, in a sense, taking off from Sarah's paper, that's also about Harrison's. I was curious, I mean, given the, in a couple of decades, I suppose, that passed between Jenner's book and the kind of intellectual context in which it was taking place and the present, in what way we can think about the sort of ideological and methodological changes social theory and to what extent those critiques might still be relevant. Because one thing that I thought was particularly interesting was in the argument that you made was the attention to the critique, well, not even the critique, just kind of repudiation of totality as a category of social thought. And that's obviously very present, obviously very present for social theory, sociology now, but I think in a rather different key, and in a way, the sort of methodological, but perhaps implicitly political asceticism of the kind of neo-Kantian position has fallen by the wayside for a very different way of arguing against totality. So, for instance, if you take things that are all the rage in at least certain sociology departments. Things like actor network theory. I'd be hard pressed to see that. I mean, it might be interesting to see that as a kind of distant, distant effect. But nevertheless, what's quite key about that is a much laxer relationship towards anything like method, a sort of emphasis not in categories of individuality, but in categories of multiplicity, which we could argue are kind of corrupt versions of character, categories of individuality. So that's in a sense what I was kind of curious about. All of these, whether it's Latour, in a sense, people like the Gibson Graham book, etc., this kind of idea that capitalism doesn't exist, all we have are multiplicities, totality is a useless category, but not for the same reasons, it seems to me. So I was curious, to what extent do you think Gillian Rose's work provides still a useful counter to contemporary ways of denying social totality?
Questions? Please.
Okay, so I just want to say I really enjoyed both your papers. My question is addressed to Harrison about your use of the absolute towards the end. So you say that it's a way for us to help think about bourgeois consciousness and property rights and so forth. So from my understanding of the absolute, and I may be incorrect, but absolute, it's not God's eyes perspective about the truth of history, right? So you're looking down and seeing and identifying, you know, facts, so to speak, about the world. But it happens from specific concrete mediation of people, right? So then my question is, where does your criteria for distinguishing between animal spirituality that you talk about and authentic spirituality? Because I think if you pursue that kind of language, your Hegelian critique tends to look a lot more like a strictly historical materialism, right? That you know the truth and that we don't have it, and then there's a language, false consciousness, I think.
One more question before they answer. Please.
I think that the distinction between dialectic and the revolutionary dialectic and the conservative system has a very old history. This is very clear in the post-Hegelian tradition. And in my opinion, the post-Hegelians misunderstood Hegel, because we cannot find this kind of distinction in Hegel, and we cannot find, this is very important, the distinction between real and rational. And in my opinion, the young Marx didn't understand Hegel, because, for example, it is absolutely false that the Stände in the Hegel's philosophy of rights means a return in the Middle Ages or something else. In my opinion, we have to understand this connection between real and rational in two ways. The real is rational, as Hegel writes, because the rational is real, because the idea is real. And the idea is the real, concrete, existing freedom in the sense of the philosophy of right. Now, I think this is my problem and my question. If we try to return to the neo-Kantianism or the post-Kantianism, and we try to divide real and rational, or idea and ideal, we return in a pre-Hegelian, but in the sense of a metaphysical conception of the distinction or dualism between theory and praxis. Mm-hmm. And I think we don't need such a kind of dualism, because Hegel is perhaps useful today to overcome this form of the dualism between theory and praxis. Okay.
Great. Thank you so much. Sarah Harris.
Well, I thought there was. Oh, okay.
No, I'm thinking 3-1, and then we'll do 3 more, and so on and so forth. So.
Okay. There is so much. Okay. Maybe I will try to comment on the question by Alberto together with what Jean said at the beginning, because especially your question, I find it stimulating, very interesting, and I would like to think more what it means now for social theory to not think necessarily in terms of individualities in the neo-Kantian sense, but even to understand networks and multiplicities, etc. But I mean, said that, I think that the argument by Rawls in general about social theory still holds, in the sense that in the end, the final result, what she's trying to say is the absolute, if you want, separation of disciplines, which meant in the neo-Kantian lexicon, that what it means by objectification is precisely the construction of different object domains for which you can develop different